Hello, we're Alex Rouget and Lee Chambers, and you're listening to a Bookmark podcast.
For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit the music chosen by our studio guest, but we hope you still enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark with me, Alex Rouget.
And me, Lee Chambers.
On today's programme, we've got the wonderful Karen Freeborn in. She is a novelist, poet and also a teacher of creative writing. So we'll also be talking to Lucy Deneen, who's a short story writer and a lecturer at ARU as well.
And I did an interview with a creative writing group run by Ruthie Collins from the Cambridge Arts Salon.
So lots about creative writing education, which is quite timely because there's recently been this article, this speech by Hanif Qureshi, where he was rather damning about creative writing education, wasn't he? So this is what our little chat's going to be about, Lee. What did you think of what Hanif Qureshi had to say?
Well, I think there's two issues, really. One is, it's interesting that he's so critical of it. In fact, as you say, damning of it while accepting a salary and continuing to work on the course. If he felt that negative about it, I would resign or try to change from within. But nevertheless,
yeah.
We've both done creative writing MAs, haven't we? And it is one of those things that's interesting. When you tell people you're doing a creative writing MA, people always say instantly, can you teach it? Well, you know, I think you can. I think there are certain techniques that you can learn. Maybe you can't, you know, if somebody is either has talent or hasn't, but you can make them the best that they can be. And I certainly know from my experience that I learnt, well, I wrote a novel. I could never have written a novel without having done the creative writing MA, learning about point of view, tense, all those things. And I actually think I learnt more than I realised at the time. I think I absorbed a lot without really, you know, being aware of it. And just being around people who are talking about writing and taking it seriously and taking yourself seriously as a writer, which you certainly do if you do an MA, because there's a financial commitment. All of that, I think, it means that I would recommend somebody do a creative writing MA. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I feel very much the same way. I mean, what Hanif Qureshi was saying was that they're a waste of time, which I think is probably quite headline-grabbing, and he probably knew that. And he talked about how a lot of his students just can't tell a story. And perhaps I understand that there might be somewhat an obsession with the prose itself, and perhaps in some of those courses that there isn't so much of a focus on story, but that's down to those courses and what they're teaching and what they're expecting of their students. And I think what you say is right. Any kind of education, I think, is just an expansive experience. It's something that it transforms you, and for me that was certainly the case, and it makes you more serious about writing. Now, Karen, we'll bring you in here. Obviously, you teach creative writing.
I do,
so
indeed,
how
yes.
did you feel when you read his comments?
Well, as Lee says, it's attention grabbing. Of course it is. And like you, Alex, I'm a bit cross that he dares to take a salary. Well, it's not so much that he's damning of creative writing, but he's so dismissive of his students. And quite honestly, if I spoke about any of my students like that, I think they'd have the right to complain. The thing about creative writing, no, it's not going to turn somebody who can't write at all into a genius. Of course it isn't. And in some ways, I think creative writing courses can be accused of selling dreams that aren't going to be fulfilled. And but it's a chance to focus for a year on your writing. It's a chance to be part of a creative community. And it's definitely a chance to think seriously about technique. No one would say of an artist that they shouldn't go to art school. No one would say that. And of course, art is the same. You can't make somebody be a great artist if they have no talent, but you can teach them technique.
Why do you think we are so much more critical of a writer trying to learn craft as opposed to an artist or a sculptor or somebody?
I think writers are very invested in it can't be taught.
Yes.
Because I personally am this great talent, but I can't teach it to you. that's
yeah.
what people are invested in.
Yeah.
But also, I think in this country, it's very different in America. All respectable writers there have a stint at teaching creative writing. And I don't think that in America you necessarily produce a uniformity of style, which some creative writing courses do and are guilty of in this country, because it's a new discipline here, and because of the recession, publishing is a very scared industry. So that's another reason. But ARU, in fact, does not have a house style, I'm very proud to say, and we produce all kinds of different writers from different genres and different types, and that's great.
And Hanif Qureshi, not wanting to stick the knife into him.
Oh, why not? Stick it in.
I think he can look after himself. Yes. He did say, I think earlier, maybe about 2 or 3 years ago, that he gives all his students the same mark. And I thought then, you know, how, as you say, how disrespectful. Yes, I can't remember what it was. It was sort of 55, something like that. How disrespectful to the students who are, as you say, there to learn something and have ambitions, and some of whom are very talented.
And that's outrageous. Lucy Dineen, who I know you're going to talk to today, and I were marking some major projects together this week, and we were literally debating for hours over a mark. We take that much care. So it's disgraceful that somebody of his calibre should be that dismissive.
Yeah. Oh, Hanif, yeah. Yeah.
That told him, didn't it?
Oh, dear. We're going to go to some music now. Your first track is by Emmylou Harris. Two More Bottles of Wine. Why did you choose this, Karen?
Oh, I wonder why I chose this. I mean, I was a party girl for a long time, and I still am a bit more of a lightweight party girl these days since my kids. But basically, this song used to be about me.
Two More Bottles of Wine by Emmylou Harris. Fantastic track, chosen by our guest today on Bookmark, Karen Freeborn. Karen is a novelist, poet and teacher who also writes occasional educational journalism. Her first novel, Three Blind Mice, was described in The Independent as brilliantly written in the vernacular, a complex book exploring family status and love. Her second, Prohibitions, was called an illuminating narrative on the extremes of human emotions. She has just finished her third novel, a reworking of a Greek tragedy, which is currently with her agent. Karen came to education late, having dropped out at a young age, and she was a mature student at Cambridge's Lucy Cavendish College at the age of 26, which is not that mature from where we're all sitting now. And she's the first person in her family to have a university education. In her late 30s, she had her children, and one of them was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, which for a while stopped writing altogether. But she is now back to it, writing poetry as well as teaching at ARU, creative writing, and she's previously taught at Cambridge University, specialising in the tragedies. So quite a busy lady, Karen.
Yeah.
But first of all, we want to hear about the party girl years. Why do you describe yourself as a party girl?
Well, basically, I think if you don't have children and you keep not having children for a very long time, then you can really prolong those teenage years, can't you? And that's what I did with a vengeance. At one time, people used to think, I think that I'd had a drink problem. Of course, I never did have a drink problem, only sometimes that the bars wouldn't keep serving after a certain time. But I was always the one last at the party, 4 o'clock in the morning, you know. I was always the one not having the second or third drink, having the second or third bottle, you know. And no, I don't think it was a waste of those years. No, I don't think it was a terrible thing to do. I had a blast. Why not?
And it certainly has informed your writing. You've got your wonderful, tough, quirky, fun character, well, not always fun, but of Rosie, in Three Blind Mice. And she's a bit of a party girl, isn't she?
She is, yes. And I think it does inform, anything that happens to you informs your writing, doesn't it? I think to go back to creative writing, when we talk about writing what you know, that doesn't mean sicking up everything that has happened to you in an actual sense, but it means taking those experiences and transforming them in some way, doesn't it? So yeah, a lot of my characters in my poetry as well seem to like a drink, just in that.
And you're talking about transformation there, and the fact that you came to education slightly later than others, and education really was a transformative experience for you. Do you want to tell us about that?
It was radically transformative. I never belonged anywhere. I knew I was out of step always. And I'm sure a lot of people feel like that. I'm sure perhaps even most people feel like that. But I was never going to conform. I was never going to be a hairdresser. I grew up in Basildon, which is a new town, and at that time it's exclusively working class. And the ambitions that your parents had for you were of a very particular kind: marriage, babies, and a nice little job. And if you had a nice little job in an office, you'd really made it. And that's great if that's what you want, but it wasn't what I wanted. But I didn't really know what else was out there. I was an autodidact. I read my way through the library. I read my way through every secondhand bookstall on Pitsy Market. And and I read Jude the Obscure. And Jude the Obscure is my book. It's about me. So I felt... And in fact, I called my first son Jude in memory of that time. But it revolutionised my life, education. And that's one of the reasons I can't understand why anybody would diss any form of education, quite honestly.
Can I ask you about that background? Because it was working class, as you say, very loving, very supportive, but very hard as well. You've written before that you were a drug addict at 14. Your father paid protection money to the Krays. It's not your kind of average childhood.
No, that's not quite. Those weren't what I wrote about. That was what was written about me, and that isn't true. I took drugs, but that's not the same as being a drug addict. I wasn't remotely a drug addict. I just did take a lot of drugs. So there's that. And it wasn't my father paying protection to the Krays. My uncle had a scrap metal yard. He paid protection to the Krays. So, but all very civilised. Nobody was horrible to him, you know. And you know, they'd give you a few bob if they saw you. So it really, when you're written about, when my first novel came out, they were looking for how they could sell me, and that's how they felt they could sell me. It actually did a hell of a lot. My mum cried and cried when the Mirror wrote about me, you know, and it was horrible. I didn't care except insofar as it affected my family. But and one article said I'd wanted to be a stripper. Yes, when I was three. I mean, look at me. I'm not delusional.
I mean, has it affected your relationship with your family, the way that education's changed you, as it always does? How have they responded to you?
It can't not change it. My family don't read my material. Why would they? They're not interested in those kinds of books, and they certainly wouldn't read poetry. My dad, who we lost in 2001, he used to say, yeah, people don't like poetry. Girl, they pretend to like poetry. But they don't really like, because it's boring, isn't it? It's boring. Thanks, Dad.
Well, speaking of creative writing, which we were doing, and in fact we were ranting about creative writing, I went along to a writing group organised by the Cambridge Arts Salon and run by Ruthie Collins. I spoke to three of the participants there, Helen Anderson, Alexandra Martinez and Julie Chalder Mills. But firstly, I asked Ruthie to tell me about the course.
This is the first time that I've run it, and the inspiration for it really came after I started up these writing days before I had my son 2.5 to 3 years ago. And they were all female writing days where women could come together, write and network and maybe have a workshop or see a writer give a talk, etc. And I was absolutely blown away by how popular the concept was. And so thought it would be great to kind of develop that into a course. Really, the kind of the original inspiration was myself as a writer. I've always written ever since I was a little girl, but when I was a teenager, I interned on a feminist magazine. I was their youngest ever intern. It was called Every Woman, based in London. I was part of a feminist media project here in Cambridge at quite a young age. It just gave me so much confidence to be in that kind of environment and be nurtured by quite a strong, like a media facilitator, I suppose you'd call it. It just gave me some amazing skills, and I've always wanted to sort of give something like that back. I worked on a magazine called Inspirational Woman. The ethos of that publication was to kind of bring women together, empower women through community and connection, and so I poured a lot of that ethos into the course, really.
So when people ask why women, only women, your answer would be because that's a more nurturing environment or safer environment for...
It's a funny one. I think it's purely just talking from personal experience. Literally over the years, I've just found that having that kind of all-female space, there's something quite intimate about it. And when you're just beginning to write, having that sense of trust is so important. Yeah.
So how does this group work?
Well, I structured it in two parts. The first part was 4 weeks of creative writing and lots of motivational exercises. But the main focus was actually looking at female authors, really, really interesting authors every week, and quite a rich, diverse range of authors. So we had like French philosopher Helene Sue, Menna van Prague, who's a local writer, and then actually writing in response to those writers. So it's kind of 50% book club and 50% actual writing time as well. And then the final 4 weeks was on looking at lifestyle journalism. So it was really just kind of designed to get women writing, I've been quite kind of high on assignments, setting homeworks, and helping the women develop the beginnings of a portfolio. Not so much on the critical side of it, because I think when you're starting to write, actually it's more process is more important than product, and there's nothing worse than kind of having those kind of initial steps shot down with too much criticism. So it's very much process-oriented, the whole course, really.
And women share their work here?
If they want to. There's no pressure to. It's only if they want to. Again, that's quite important, I think. Yeah.
And it's quite a small group.
Yeah.
So people get to know each other and each other's writing very well.
That's it, yeah. We've had 5 participants. Next year, I might open it up perhaps to a couple more, but I deliberately wanted to keep it quite small. Again, high on intimacy and just trust and safety is really important.
And your own writing?
Yes.
You're a writer as well?
I am, yes.
And has this helped your writing, doing these workshops with other writers?
Yeah, it has actually. Seeing the value of writing in other people kind of makes you value your own practice more, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And what do you write?
At the moment I write mostly kind of arts journalism and freelance journalism for other publications. So it's quite diverse, really. I write about the Cambridge art scene for Cambridge Edition magazine, and then write about kind of travel and parenting and basically modern-day women for other publications. I've got my own personal creative writing practice, so I tend to exhibit my writing at shows when I do share my more kind of experimental stuff.
And amongst the women that you've got attending this course, how many are interested in journalism and how many are interested in creative writing, or is it a mixture really?
They seem to have responded pretty enthusiastically throughout the whole course to both sides of it. I mean, they're quite different practices, and the creative writing had quite a different feel to the lifestyle journalism. So, yeah, you have to ask them.
I will. It would have been nice to have spent more time on both, you know, the creative and the journalistic style of writing. It seems scarier. But yeah, it's something that's interesting because for me it's about having that balance. The novel is about pleasure, about indulging yourself in that fantasy or whatever it might be, whereas a journalistic or a magazine or however we want to frame it, it seems like it's a bit more real life, so it's got to be a bit more accurate, relevant to the time, I guess. Since I've been a little girl, I've had this dream of writing a book. I love writing and I love being part of a group. So when this opportunity was mooted by Ruthie, I've known her a few years, jumped at the chance at being in a space that's dedicated to focusing your mind on the job at hand. So it's about relearning what it is about writing that I love and where I want it to go, and just rekindling that, really, because you can't, you know, life gets in the way. You're working and all of those things, and the writing for pleasure has kind of gone by the wayside. So by coming here, it was about finding out a little bit who the person is that I think I am and trying to get some emotional and intellectual support from the women here. I believed it was important for my psyche that I was in a group of women because I felt that at the most basic level we were equal in that we were women. Whether or not there was any competitiveness in that group, I had no idea. But I would expect that within a mixed gendered group. And knowing Ruthie, I knew it would be a very gentle space and a very supportive space, which I don't believe I would have expected within a mixed gender group. And I was just saying to one of the other girls earlier about how, since I was little, I've had a pseudonym in my head, which was my grandmother's name, and I never met her. And so it was like it's like a homage to my late dad, who idolised his mum because she died when he was only six. So when it eventually happens, it will be in her name.
Writing was something that I'd been thinking about doing, and I was at a point in my life where I kind of needed to get out and meet some new people as well. I thought that doing a creative writing course could combine those two. But I think that the techniques and the kind of ways into writing that we've discussed on the course have been quite useful, and I have produced some small things, but I guess it's just useful to know that basically everything that you produce is a valid thing.
I'm really happy about taking this course because I have learned a lot. I have met really, really nice people. I have really good feelings about the experience. But I have started two short stories. One of them is about, I don't know if I can say science fiction because it's like in another planet, so maybe yes it is. It's just based in a task that Ruthie gave us. It's just we had to make some pairs of opposites and use maybe four or five of them and create a story about this. Creativity is important, but it's not the most important fact. The most important fact is discipline. Keep writing. Maybe I can have thousands of brilliant ideas, but if I don't write them, it's nothing. It's exactly the same. Keep writing, keep writing, keep writing.
And that was Alessandra Martinez there, one of the participants of the creative writing workshop run by the Cambridge Arts Salon and Ruthie Collins. And they're running another workshop this year called the Literary Bells Project. And if you want more information about that, go to the Cambridge Arts Salon website. We've got Karen Freeborn in the studio. Keep writing, keep writing, keep writing, Alessandra said there. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I always tell my students that the best writing advice comes from Stephen King. Read a lot and write a lot. It's as simple as that, really. Mm-hmm. And I was interested that your guest doesn't build in criticism at an early stage. I actually think it's useful to get used to that discipline, because you're going to have to be able to take it on the chin and negotiate with any criticism you get, and negotiate with your piece of writing in relation to that criticism, even if what you're writing initially is a limerick.
And how did you start out? So when you did begin education at Lucy Cavendish, you were doing English.
Yeah.
And so at what point did you think to yourself, I could be a writer?
I've always written, okay, all my life. Mm-hmm. I've written since I could hold a pen. I've never wanted to do anything else. I just didn't know it was possible.
Well, that's what, yeah, so in your family it wasn't seen as something that was done, but at what point did you think this could happen, this is possible?
I'm still waiting. I suppose just being around people who took books seriously all the time meant that I was writing in a more focused way. And I think if you're writing in a more focused way, you then perhaps start to seek out like-minded people. And I was mentored by a friend's brother, actually, of all things, but a friend who I met through Lucy Cavendish. And he read my writing for me. He was a writer. And he eventually sent the writing to an agent, not an agent he knew, but an agent who said, yep, cut it by 35,000 words and I'll sell it. So I cut it by 35,000 words. I didn't know that was a big deal. I was a novice. What did I know? I just went, okay, I can do that. And actually, of course, that's a very good lesson. And it is one, again, that I tell all my students, you very seldom miss the words you cut out.
And your novels are very much about that seedy side of life, pornography, crime. What is it about that? Are you just simply writing about that because that's part of your background, or are you using that to talk about something else?
Well, I don't write about that anymore, actually, because you move on, don't you? You become a different writer. If you stay static, then you're just mass producing something. But you're quite right that that I used it metaphorically. Of course I did. I've always been interested in power, and I suppose in a way I'm still writing about that, just using a different set of metaphors now. Interested in power, interested in vulnerability, and interested in the way we watch each other. A lot of my interests are, I suppose, still about voyeurism, but again, in different ways now.
I mean, certainly not afraid of any subjects, are you?
No, absolutely not. I don't think writers can be, whether that's of things that are quite controversial, or whether it's about using emotions that seem dangerous. I mean, Graham Greene, didn't he said that there's a splinter of ice in the heart of every writer, and I think he's right.
And you take your characters to some very dark places. You're not afraid of that either. But again, why is that? What are you trying to say about the human condition?
I just think in some ways I've got a very bleak view of human nature, I think that would be fair to say. But actually, I think you talked about how Cambridge led me into writing the things that I do. And I think you're right. I think it was my interest in tragedy, actually, my intellectual interest in tragedy. Because for me, it seems that tragedy asks us questions about what it means to be fully human. Now, it asks us those questions differently at different times in history, and it requires different answers, but it is always returning to that. What does it mean to be fully human? And I think by going to those dark places, you're asking those questions in quite extreme ways. The novel that's currently with my agent is a working of the Medea. And Medea murders her children. Doesn't get much darker than that. And my agent went, "Oh, Karen, must you?" Yes, sorry, Louise. Yes.
Well, I wish I could say we're going to lift the tone now, but your next piece of music is by Leonard Cohen.
Yes, sorry.
Why did you choose this? I thought perhaps we can guess.
Well, I do love the dark side, but it's more, but I don't do music without words. I've always loved words, and it seems to be the thing that Cohen is a brilliant storyteller. Community Radio in your city.
Hello and welcome back to Bookmark. We have Karen Freeborn in the studio with us. Karen, you're going to do a reading for us now of some of your poetry.
I am, yes. Three sonnets from a sonnet sequence that I'm currently working on. The first one is really about shifts in register as much as anything else, and it's called Massacre. You gave me back a severed head, dripping dour over my sheets. "Well, you can just clear that up," I said, "nasty thing. Look at that sneer. There's a reason I chucked it." Gripping its hair, you stared through its eyes. "You're slipping," I said. "Last year, my surprise was a rose." Drear streaked your face. I swear that head leered back. "For the love of God, get that flipping thing out," I said. "Why did you give me a dead Valentine?" So this year, I'll lever out my heart, wrap it in a shell. Hold it to your ear, you'll hear it beat. I'll feed it on my worth, so it should keep. You need not part. Well, never did get the blood out them sheets. This second poem is about the brother of a child with special needs. It's called Remedial Recovery. You were so afraid of staying in for playtime that you wrote reams, certificates in assembly, attention to detail, great work rewarded here. It's stuck in your craw. Fine, chewy word, that craw. You called it cruel, your trees should be made of paper. Later, you read stories torched at 30 feet, scratched into bark, imagination sore. Your brother was born without a tail. In his beginning was my end. You flew past us, though I stabbed at you with my pen, trying to pin you to the page. I failed. Schlepped into form, unbrushed, unkissed, askew, afoot. Prose slips through my fingers like wine. And this last one, I wrote after hearing something really, really shocking. And if it shocks me, it must be shocking. It's called Life Lessons. My sons smoke contemplatively, gazing at the hooker they've just killed. Awesome! Proud of their achievement, they loudly call me from roast chicken and potatoes and raised bread dough. "Look, Mum!" I'm amazed and say so. My hands cracked across, unbreath. "Where have you found this?" They shrug, thin-shouldered, punter-eyed. "How'd we know? It just arrived." Awaiting praise. Of course they want approval for their crime. They're 8 and 9. I tuck them up at night, well versed in burps and bears and bellicose giants. Stroke their tangled hair, line up their teddies in size order, give chase to fright, lie about heaven. Well done, boys, I choke.
Wow, it's powerful stuff there, Karen. So how long have you been, when did you start writing poetry?
When I was 46 and I'm 48 now. My juvenilia, it's a bit embarrassing, isn't it, really? But my juvenilia is stuff I wrote when I was 46.
No, it's amazing stuff. And obviously you're still not scared, you're scared of your dark subjects. That's still coming through.
No, I'm not. It's interesting. I seem now to need to write poetry. That sounds horribly pretentious. And whenever anybody says anything like that, I think, oh, please give me a rest. But actually, it does seem to me that the relationship between compression and dilation that poetry offers is something that is really, really interesting to me at the moment. And actually, if you're interested in the dark side, if you are fascinated by human behaviours, they tend to inhere in the moments anyway, and I think that that's an interesting place to be.
And why the sonnet? I know you're a Shakespeare scholar, but yeah. Is that connected to it?
Yes, absolutely, although I don't write Shakespearean sonnets, they're Petrarchan.
Of course, of course. You knew that, didn't you, Lee?
but I don't just write sonnets, and in fact, going back to creative writing, I was teaching a course called Writing Poetry at ARU. Of course, I love teaching and really interested students, and it's great. And I was teaching the Sestina, and the poet Ian Paterson had always told me that there's a rule if you teach the Sestina. If you teach it, you must write one. So 10 o'clock the night before this class, I thought, oh, no, I've forgotten to write my Sestina. So I wrote one. And interestingly enough, it's just taken second prize in the Sentinel Annual Poetry Competition, which is a big comp. Brilliant. And I'm really thrilled with this, but it's interesting that it shows that the exercises can turn into real poems too.
That's fantastic. We're going to come back to more about your poetry and your teaching, but first of all, we have an interview with your colleague, Lucy Dineen. She's a short story writer and lecturer at ARU. Her stories have been published in literary journals such as the Manchester Review, Short Fiction, the Lightship Anthology and Poetry Island Review. And one of her stories was shortlisted for the Bridport Prize. I asked her about the appeal of the short story.
I think there's a couple of things, really. One is that you can put on lots of different voices and pick up and put down voices. I quite like that, that every story can be different. It's a different person, it's a different tone. Ian McEwan talks about ventriloquism and sort of trying on different clothes when he was learning the craft of the short story, and I found that's been quite helpful for me as a when I began to start writing short stories, that idea of trying out different voices and finding ones that I was comfortable with, and then being able to pick up characters whenever I wanted to as well. But also there's something about the compression, I think, of a short story. It's a very powerful beast because so much is contained, isn't that, of course, the famous Hemingway adage of the iceberg and the 9/10 below the surface. But I think it's more than that. It's just this moment, this intense moment, and I like creating them, and I like reading them as well. So, yeah.
Who are your favourites? Who do you love to read the most?
Oh, well, I do love Hemingway. I'm not sure if that's very politically correct sometimes for women to say love
that.
Hemingway.
Yeah.
But I do. Carver, Raymond Carver. I like quite a lot of contemporary short story writers. Wells Tower I like very much, Miranda July. But again, I think it's the lovely thing about short stories is that you can, there's such a raft of them to be discovered. So unlike novels where I've got favourite novels and favourite novelists, with short stories I find it's the stories that draw me in, and I'll pull them from wherever they come from. You know, it's...
And what do you think have you found to be the biggest challenge? Because they are famously very difficult, but people find different things difficult about them. So structure, management of time. Is there anything in particular that always challenges you?
Not so much anymore, because when I first started writing, I always thought I'd be a novelist, and I'm quite waffly generally. So I always thought that the only way I could ever say everything I wanted to say was if I had 100,000 words to say it. And I gradually started to explore the form and realise, I mean, when I first started doing it, they were sort of 10,000 words long, so they weren't that short. But the more I found I gained control over the craft of the short story, the easier it became. And actually now I find that the challenge is going to be making things longer. So for me, the short story, I find it's like a natural length almost. It's sort of they make their own length very much. And once you become comfortable with that means of compression, it's a very satisfying way of telling a story. But I think we're all naturally short storytellers, really, because we all go home, tell a friend or a partner about the day we've had at work, and we compress it, we get rid of the superfluous information, we exaggerate the bits that are most exciting, and we automatically put it into that small, neat, contained form. So I think in a sense it's quite a natural way of telling stories.
I recently met Helen Simpson, and she said that she didn't think the short story was the place to explore character, which I thought was really interesting. I wonder what you thought about that.
Well, I suppose the short story perhaps typically utilises stock characters that we perhaps recognise for their sort of maybe more cliched traits almost, because a quicker route into the character is to have certain recognisable elements. And I notice actually with some of my own stories, I do this a lot. Sometimes I don't even name them. There'll be the mother, the father, the daughter. They're sort of embodying a type, a bit like a fairy tale, I suppose. So I suppose from that point of view, we rely on maybe more familiar aspects of character rather than a novel where they're much more complex. But at the same time, I like stories that give a character a chance to almost see another side of themselves.
Do you think that these big competitions, or the way that the short story market in the UK particularly seems very set up towards prizes, do you think that's a good thing for the short story?
I think anything that exposes it is a good thing for the short story. It's a form that, funnily enough, lots of people read short stories, lots of people love short stories, and yet we're constantly being told that agents don't want them and publishers don't want them in the same way. You can find placement through individual publications, but as a new writer to go out with a collection, it's quite hard to find the right place for it. So anything that draws more attention to them has got to be fantastic. Sometimes I think the competitions invite a certain type of short story. I see very similar types of story winning competitions, and certain kinds that are maybe less fashionable, or the twist and the tale type of story still doesn't seem very fashionable, although I think it's coming back into its own a little bit. But I'm not entirely sure they represent the breadth of the short story as it is today.
I suppose, but if they're looking at thousands of stories, and they can possibly miss a good story that's a quiet story.
Mm. Yeah, I think quiet stories don't fare so well for competitions, but actually they're often the most powerful ones. So,
and on your website, you know, you're using multimedia a lot. Do you think that's becoming much more important in the short story form?
I think it's becoming much more important for writers generally. It works nicely with the short story form. It provides platforms for short stories that previously didn't exist. I enjoy bringing together images and stories from a personal point of view. I like a lot of photography. I do a lot of photography myself. So I find that idea of that analogy of the short story being like a snapshot, I think that works quite nicely. It makes me think harder about how I want my stories to develop. I do think these days quite consciously, could they have a multimedia element to them? Is it possible to bring something else to them? It means that then every time you read them, potentially they could be a little bit different. Mm. So rather than being a static thing on a page.
Oh, it's exciting. And you've also got a project that you're running on your site. Can you tell us about that, a story in a week?
That is on a hiatus, I think, is the best way to put it, now that I'm here.
But the concept behind it was to try and get you yourself to be writing much more regularly.
Because it's very difficult to carve out writing time. I think all of us writers will know this. But I was also quite interested in trying to make myself write about things that I didn't really either know about or care about, perhaps, instead of going for very familiar themes and images and ideas. And I wanted to see what would happen if I was told what to write about, which is something I suppose I do in my teaching. I set writing exercises and I expect students to, you know, in the context of the classroom, to go away and write something, which I don't have that. I don't impose that on myself anymore, and I don't have a class that can do that for me. So I thought it'd be quite interesting just to see what happened if I was given the challenge. And I like the idea of being able to use Twitter, use Facebook to invite those sort of suggestions in.
Do you think perhaps we're too excited about the opportunities that things like social media can bring us in terms of, you know, what's going to happen to the short story in the context of social media?
Well, you mentioned before about digital media, and I think there's a difference between the possibilities that are offered by new media platforms and social networking. And I'm not convinced that social networking is very helpful for writing. I think it's something we're expected to explore, but it's quite a time drain. It's writing about writing, but not actually writing. And I'm not convinced that that's how people really are discovering new writers. I think they're still doing that by going to bookshops, by seeing readings, by, you know, recommendations. So for me, that feels like a different area. And
it's
marketing. And I know writers are more and more expected to understand how to market themselves. And it's not a bad thing to know how to do that. But it can detract from the actual business of putting words on paper. So
definitely. So tell us about your role at Angela Ruskin.
Well, I am this semester lecturing in the short story and the second year module writing short fiction and experimental writing. I also do some teaching on the MA. I did the short story module last semester, which was wonderful, really, really fun module. And I'm the course leader for the undergraduate writing programme, so that's quite a lot to keep me busy.
Yes, absolutely.
And we're working on putting on events, writing events, open mics, particularly for poetry, encouraging students to become comfortable with reading, sharing their own work, and that's been very, very popular.
Great.
Extremely popular.
So what advice do you give the budding short story writer?
It probably seems a little obvious, but just to write. I think the best advice that was ever given to me was, it doesn't have to be good, it just has to be written. Once it's on paper, you go back to the second draft, the third draft, you make the magic happen then. But a blank sheet of paper is never going to do anything. So you write through it. You just have to put words down on paper. And then once you see what's starting to emerge, that's how you can then shape it. That's how you start to turn it into a short story. Personally, I tend to find the endings come to me first. And I'll hear the ending and I'll know the story can be written. I don't think everyone works that way by any means, but trust your instincts. Whichever way you choose to write is the right way for you, and don't ever feel there's a magic formula that's the way to do it. You have to sort of listen to your instincts and just write.
So another tutor saying just write there.
Yes.
We've got the message. We need to go away and write. I was going to go back to something you said about teaching. You might not remember saying this, but it says, Karen, you said, what my students get in essence is a literature groupie, a wave of metaphorical knickers. And this approach can be for some infectious. Would you say that's still true?
I wrote that somewhere, didn't I? Yes, absolutely I would. I am first and foremost a reader. You know, and I'm quite shocked sometimes by people who want to be writers. So it's the thing you can be anyway, rather than the thing that you just are, who don't seem to read or not very much. What the hell do they want to do then?
Yeah.
I don't get it. I literally don't get it. I am just as much in love with books as ever I was, you know.
And you've also had, we've talked a little bit about your background and how that your education then made your family react to you. But you also had some difficult reactions from your students at Cambridge University, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I mean, my accent, you know, you can probably hear I've still got a regional accent, but obviously over the years it has modified. And obviously I'm code switching here a bit, speaking a bit formally because I'm on the radio being posh. Like. But they initially used to think I was joking. A lot of the time. I mean, no, this is a serious point. Oh, yeah. No, I'm not joking. And because they were used to it being a comedic register, my accent, my Essex girl accent, you know. And they also, some of the public school boys, suspected I might not be up to the job. So I had, for a while, to be twice as hard as other supervisors and twice as tough just to be getting just to be taken seriously. They took me seriously in the end.
Didn't one of them say to you, I didn't expect to come to Cambridge University and be taught by an Essex girl in stilettos?
That's right,
yeah. Shocking. I hope you threw one of those stilettos at his head.
I should have done, shouldn't I?
So let's go back to your poetry now. So, you've been writing about autism.
Yes.
Tell us
absolutely.
About that.
I think when my son was diagnosed, he was three, and for a while I couldn't write anything. And then when I started writing again, it was a non-fiction account of autism, and I wrote obsessively about autism. I talked obsessively about autism. I was an autism bore. And what I've done now, I hope what I've done now, is translated that. So while I'm interested in difference and I'm still interested in power, so although I'm not in my poems ever writing directly about him, I do write about the autistic experience from both sides, whether it's from the side of a neurotypical or from the side of somebody with autism.
You've spoken about the theory of mind
yes.
before. What is that?
The theory of mind, put briefly, is the theory that people with autism can't have empathy and don't understand other people having different feelings from them. That is rubbish. It's discredited by a lot of autism activists, and actually I think it's more accurate to talk about a different theory of mind, or a different pace of theory of mind, really. Some people with autism actually react more to other people's feelings, to the point where their synapses are firing all over the place, and it's actually really hard to cope with all they're feeling in relation to the other person and what they're feeling. So it's actually about understanding that people have different kinds of manifestations of compassion.
And how have you used your experience of being a parent of an autistic child in your writing? Have you used it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mine everything. I really do have that splinter of ice in my heart. Nothing is sacred. Well, I say that's not quite true. I wouldn't write about the reality of him now. I wrote about the reality of him till he was five. He is now nine, and I don't write about him now, but I do constantly write about the relationship between the neurotypical and the autist. I write about that all the time, and it's something that fascinates me and makes me despair, and I want to get it out there. And that's one thing I think that poetry is really, really useful for, because I talked about it in Hearing in the Moments. I talked about that compression of language and experience, and I think that's one way we can understand in those moments.
And is it something you can use outside something you've written specifically about autism? Is it something that you can use when you're talking about characters relating to one another?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I think that if you're an intellectual, and I'm absolutely fed up with this country, then you're not allowed to define yourself as an intellectual because somehow it's being too big for your boots and thinking you're really clever. Oh, she thinks she's big-headed, but she's not. But I think if you are an intellectual, of course that you're going to have an intellectual interest in even the things that happen to you personally, and you are going to be able to translate those aesthetically and creatively into your work. Absolutely.
Can you see yourself going back to a novel with this subject, or is that too difficult to contemplate?
Yes, I can.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Is
yes.
that the next project then?
It's one that I'm working on now, yes. I don't have a great deal of time to work in great swathes of prose at the moment, but it is something that I am working on, although focusing more on the poetry at the moment.
You were, you have been in the past, I think you still are, one of those super women kind of writers that you managed to fit it in those edges of time, didn't you? Tell us about your process of when you wrote your novels and now.
Yes, I write in small corners because that's all I have. I don't want that to sound like a sob story or anything, but I have to earn a living, and I earn a living where I can. So I teach, and that takes up an awful lot of time, not just in the time that you're teaching, but all the prep and the admin and the marking and so on. And I have two children, and one of them has additional requirements, and so those small moments, if I get an hour, if a student doesn't turn up, I write. If something has been cancelled, I write. Any 5 minutes, I write. I have no patience with writer's block. None whatsoever.
So there's no, you don't have to be in a particular mood or particular room. You just can write whenever and wherever.
Yep,
and you used to get up very, very early, didn't you, when your children were young, or and write?
I used to get up really, really early because they did.
Yeah.
And I used the time. I wouldn't have chosen that.
No.
Well, ideally, actually a night owl by temperament. But yeah, I mean, I just adapt it because you have to. If I have to take a train, I write on the train. You know, I write everywhere. That I've always got. Always keep your writer's notebook. I mean, that's one thing. Every creative writing course says keep a writer's notebook, and it's the one piece of advice that all writers I know follow. Keep a notebook and use it.
Well, thank you so much, Karen. I think we've got the message loud and clear. What we need to do, Lee, is we need to write.
Keep
always
writing.
All the time, yes. So that's what we're going to do straight after the show. Tell us about the next show, Lee.
The next show, our studio guest is Soumya Bolsari, who wrote The Cambridge Curry Club. We've got interviews with Emma Donoghue, who wrote Room, and her second novel,
Frog Music,
is just out. And an interview with Ethna Farry, who's was a Costa judge and is a book critic too. But we've got some bits and bobs to clear up. We've got to say congratulations to Julia Anderson. She won the 5 Alison Bruce novels that we put up for offer a couple of weeks ago. And we have another competition. We're starting
to
trend.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, we interviewed Diana Brody, who's a poet, and she wrote a collection called Giotto Circle. And the question, if you want to win a free signed copy of Giotto Circle, and it is a beautiful collection of poetry, so I do recommend it. The question is, in what city was the author born? Now, you can either go back and listen to the interview, which is on the podcast on our website page, which is cambridge105.fm/shows/book-night. I could give a little clue.
Go on then.
Well, she's from Down Under, and it's a city that's associated with, it's a very beautiful city associated with earthquakes, and I've been there, but that's not much of a clue.
Yeah, that's only for people who know Lee. Anyway, thank you very much, Karen. We've got your last track. Could you quickly tell us why you chose the Ramones Rock and Roll High School?
Oh, it's self-explanatory. You've got to love the Ramones, especially if you used to be a party girl.